Hey, we're here with Marty Kane, author of Kids of the Black Hole, The Wound Is Not Real, a memoir, and Skater Dad. Jake and I are just going to ask you some questions. We're interested in process, practice, how to stay sane, and the kinds of conversations you're having with writers, authors, and thinkers. And so, our first question is what thinkers excite you right now, Marty?
I would say the thinker who probably excites me the most right now is my baby, because I'm watching her learn how to think, which is pretty fucking exciting. And I mean, for me, it's sort of in some ways cemented like what I've always been excited about in poetry, which is this sort of like, I don't know, like tweaked relationship to the romantic tradition, where I'm sort of thinking about poetry and also, like, by way of Stan Brakhage, like poetry as a way of like seeing and feeling and hearing things again, like sort of getting back to a kind of like primal sensory experience. And like, incidentally, I was I guess, like, I'm still working on it, but around the time that my partner Kina, we found out that she was pregnant, and around the birth of my child, I've been working and reworking this book called The Prelude, of course, referencing Wordsworth's Prelude. And in it, I'm sort of like thinking about my own relationship to The Prelude, which is a book I'm kind of obsessed with, and romanticism and like that kind of influence and the way it's pervaded my work in general. And I feel like I should have waited to start writing the book until my kid was born, because suddenly I'm like, oh wow, like all of these things, like, I mean, like Wordsworth's Prelude, it's sort of like a Bildungsroman, and I feel like every book I write is sort of about being young and becoming a writer, which of course means like, learning what language is, the way that language can like shape us, the way that it can hurt us, and so on. So I'm like, I haven't had a ton of time to work on it lately, to be honest, but I find myself thinking a lot about like these poems I've been writing about childhood and how strange it is to be like, seeing this little kid who's my kid who I can like look at and be like, oh shit, we smile the same way or whatever. Like seeing those kinds of things is, yeah, it's yeah, that's my favorite thinker right now. But I can think of other actual people who are producing textual things. One academic, and I think I'm pretty sure she's also a poet, but I'm not super familiar with her creative work, but the writer Sophie Seda, is I read her book Provisional Avant-Gardes, which I think came out in 2019. I read that maybe a year ago, and I've just been like visiting and revisiting that book, and it's continued to be so great to me. Like, as someone who's always been interested in work that self-identifies or is identified by other people as like avant-garde writing. But she thinks about it in a way that feels very divorced from the kind of like militaristic and monolithic rhetoric that I feel like gets like ascribed to avant-garde. Like, it's a way of thinking about avant-garde writing that is like right in the title. It's provisional in the sense that it's like produced through specific temporal, institutional, geographic contexts, and like that way of thinking about avant-garde has been really useful for me as someone who like loves avant-garde writing, but like is also within the stifling context that is academia, like specifically Ivy League academia right now. And it feels stupid to like think about avant-garde writing for me as like this like thing that is pure or is like militant, because it's not. Like, it's Cornell University, it's paying for me to like pretend to traffic radical ideas right now, yeah, sorry, I just went from my kid to Cornell University. I don't know how that happened, but
That's great. And I think also, like, you know, the blurriness there, right, between or the way in which, like, our entire, like, the aspects of our family life, like, all these things are blurred in with both, like, the kind of critical spaces that you're occupying, as well as, like, as a thinking about yourself both as an intellectual and as a worker, right, someone that's attached to an institution. I think I'm thinking of all these things simultaneously is really useful, and specifically this mention of your child being, like, the most important thinker to you right now kind of leads nicely into this question we have, which is how do you access meaning or meaningfulness in your daily life? And I kind of be interested in like just the way that you went kind of through that first question in articulating these different layers to that as well.
Yeah. I mean, meaning is a challenging thing, I think, to, like, you know, locate within, like, specific spaces that it's that you're getting meaning from. I mean, like, again, like, honestly, right now, like, most of it I'm getting from, like, my day-to-day experience with my kid, because that's what I have the time. Sorry, one of my cats is trying to make it into this room right now. Like that's sort of, like, where my head is at, and that is what is consuming me, and I love it. I also wish that I had more space to kind of, like, get meaning from other things. My academic work, I think, gives me a ton of meaning, but right now it's sort of, like, clouded by the fact that I'm, like, yes, I'm, like, doing this scholarly project that I care about and excited about, but I'm also, like, you know, waiting to hear back from jobs and, like, kind of, like, trying to figure out how to position it and from this, like, kind of careerist standpoint, which doesn't take away entirely, like, what I love about it, but it makes it harder to be, like, and particularly since, like, I mean, you know, Jake, like, as a parent, like, you know that it's, like, the time that you have to do this shit is, like, fucking precious. So it's, like, when I'm, like, okay, I have, like, 2 hours to work on my dissertation right now, I don't feel like I have the space to, like, revel in just, like, the weird archival shit that, like, I kind of love doing. Like, that's what excites me about research and, like, excites me about poetry in general. It's just kind of, like, dicking around with books and, like, looking at the index and being like, oh, this leads me to this book, and then it leads me to this book, and I'm, like, on this kind of, like, chain of things, and I don't feel like I have as much space to do that right now. But yeah, I would say my family gives me a lot of meaning right now. Honestly, my hobbies, like, that's sort of that sounds like a stupid thing. Like, one of the questions that Joe sent me was, like, what is leisure? And I find myself thinking about that a lot. Like, the kind of, as I've, like, entered my 30s, I've realized how important it is for me to have interests and things that I'm excited about that cannot be assimilated into my job or any kind of careerist space. And as much as I love poetry, and that is, you know, other than my family, the most important thing to me, probably, that always, I feel like, risks being absorbed into my, like, institutional relationship to it, even though I'm, like, a literary scholar. Like, I'm not in creative writing academia at all, but it's very hard to keep those things separate, I think. And I think the kind of, like, careerist mentality of the kind of, like, you know, the that has been a thing in poetry since the rise of, like, the creative writing academic program, at least, you know, I mean, if not much older than that, that's always going to be there. And for me, it's been really, like, amazing to cultivate interests and, like, forms of leisure that give me, like, a sense of meaning outside of that. And I feel like it's, like, made me a better poet and a better scholar. Should I say what those things are? Or should I just stop there?
Yeah, hell yeah, man. What are you doing for leisure?
Well, up until it started snowing, I love skateboarding. That's, like, something that I grew up doing that was, like, a huge part of my life. But I grew up in a very rural space, divorced from the kind of like urban centers where, you know, skateboarding has like historically developed a culture. So my exposure to skateboarding was like through the X Games and these super like kind of commercialized venues. And I went to college in an even more rural place and then went to grad school in like rural Mississippi. And there was a great skate park there. And I lived across the street from it. I would look at it every day and be like, fuck, I should never have stopped skateboarding. And I never started again the entire time. And then I like, I don't know, I started my PhD, got ABD, and then just was like, I missed this shit and I wanted to start doing it again. And I've just been like kind of obsessed with it since I've picked it back up. I'm not particularly good at it, but, I think what I find most exciting about it is it is like a material culture if there ever was one. And that's something that excites me about poetry. It's like, skateboarding is not a space. It's not like an athletic thing. It's a cultural thing. And it's not just about how you are on the board. It's about like fashion. It's about videos. It's about like, you know, the consumption of skateboard media. It's about commodities to a certain extent. And like all of those, like, I don't know, different kinds of like cultural collision are so exciting to me about it. I feel like at a certain point I'm going to have to think more directly about like the relationship I see between it and like poetry, if there is one. Another thinker I'll say that is excited me a lot is this writer who's a skater, Kyle Beachy, put out this book called The Most Fun Thing this past year, which I would highly recommend. It's like an amazing, I think it's on like Grand Central, like some subsidiary of a big press, but it's a fantastic book. And it's sort of like, you know, fluctuates back and forth between like critical essays about skateboarding from a kind of like industry standpoint, like thinking critically about the commodification of it. But it also is very personal. And for me, it's just like a wonderful model of tackling that precise question, like what is leisure? And it's called The Most Fun Thing. So it's like a perfect example of that, and I would recommend it to anyone, whether you skate or not. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, and it sounds like it would be fun to put together a genealogy of skate thought or skate poets.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean there's more than you would think. There's not like a ton, but there's like there's a healthy amount of like, you know, just fucking brilliant people who skate and like write about it in really intelligent ways. So
yeah that's great. I'm in such admiration of I mean this makes me want to get really obsessed with my own hobbies and engage with those some more, which mostly is about like seed catalogs, as Jake would know. So, I mean, you've described, you know, pretty precisely the kinds of pressures that are impacting your current practice and the kind of things you're doing to escape those pressures. And you've kind of already anticipated this question a little bit, but that question is, what do you want your intellectual artistic practice to look like in, say, 20 years? You know, if right now you've got all of these, you're in a transitional phase where you have to think about career and things like that, like what would you want it to look like 20 years from now? In your, I guess, in your 50s.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I like, I have some ideas of what I would want it to look like, but if things go the way that I'm planning, I'm hoping my idea by the time I'm 50 of what it should look like will be different than my idea of like what it should look like now. But I guess I would say space, like space in like a both geographic or in both like a spatial and kind of like temporal, you know, in relation to labor kind of sense. Like I want to have like the space and the time to like focus on things that I care about. I mean, I feel like that's like kind of a boring answer because I feel like that's probably a lot of people's answer, you know. I remember when I was in undergrad, I was in this like fiction, undergrad fiction workshop. And I went to like a very like, you know, I went to like a fancy pants, like liberal arts school. So I don't know if that shapes this anecdote in terms of like, you know, how it's thinking about leisure and labor, but I think it might. But I had a friend who had this story about a writer, and he talked about the writer being on an airplane and like trying to play a game on his phone, but his phone died, and he was like super bored and like pissed off because his phone died. And the professor was like, this is like terrible. This is not a representation of a writer. All a writer wants is like time and space to write, which like I think is true to an extent, but I'm also like, I want to fucking play a game on my phone on the plane sometimes, you know? And like that kind of like I think like, yes, like I want time to write and to create, but I want like a very, I don't want like a narrow definition of like what creating is, you know? Not that like playing, you know, Snake on my Nokia phone or whatever is, that's a dated reference if there ever was one. Not if like playing Candy Crush or whatever is like, not that that's like necessarily creative, but that felt like a weird, very like New Yorker fiction writer response to like this idea of like what, you know, creative work is and like what creative labor is, if I want to even call it creative labor, which I'm not sure that I do. Yeah, so I guess by the in 20 years, I would love to like, I would love to have like, you know, more time and space now than I have now to create. And I feel like I actually, relative to a lot of other people, I have like plenty of time to create. I feel like what I don't have is like energy. And I'd love to have more of that. And I'd love to not have to make decisions like that involve like sacrificing other things that I care about. I never want to be one of those like writers who like fucking throws their family under the bus in the service of this like, you know, like fucking visionary artist archetype where you say fuck everything else except art. Like that was something I believed in high school, and then I started caring about other things and I realized that I'm that's not what I want. But
yeah, there's oh man, there's so many things that you said that are really interesting that I would love to kind of go with a little bit further. But the idea of having this space, basically like space to not be writing, right? That is, yeah, like something that like surrounds the writing, as opposed to having to like negotiate what things you are going to kind of let fall by the wayside while you are writing, essentially, is like what often ends up being what people have to choose. And so I guess I'm curious, like with this kind of attention to writing practice and this both like desire to, and also like not desire, like not to be totally consumed by it, like why do you write? What drives your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing for a very long time. I'm just going to like narrate my personal history with writing. So I'm honestly not sure what my answer is to that question. And I'm thinking that maybe by narrating that personal history, I'll come to like something like an answer. But I started like seriously writing, you know, seriously writing. I started like identifying as a writer and being like, I'm going to produce literary shit. And that's something I want to do when I was in high school. And like wrote this just like absolutely terrible novel in high school that has never seen the light of day, thank God. And like I think when I was writing that, like it was important to me for a lot of reasons, but I think a big one was like having this entire reality and this entire sense of meaning that was like specifically mine and was like wholly separate from everything else that was going on in my life and that was like valuable in my life. Like, much like now, like I feel like I was sort of, I mean, I was in high school. So my relationship to work and everything else was very different, I think, but I was writing on like borrowed time to an extent. Like, I wasn't writing for any kind of like assignment. Nobody was really like validating what I was doing, but it gave me like a sense of, I like a sense of identity, honestly. But like, I think the reason that I write now has it's changed a lot over time. And I think a lot of it has had to do with like realizing that literary culture is a thing. I mean, maybe it was because I was a fiction writer, I don't know, but I thought of writing as like this intensely solitary thing. And I think there's like a lot of like popular rhetoric, particularly for novelists. And maybe that's true. I'm working on a novel, but it's like a poet novel. So I don't really consider myself a novelist. Maybe that's still true for novelists. Maybe they still think of it as this like super solitary thing. But what I love about poetry is it like makes me feel not alone, you know? Like I have plenty of problems with it, but when I get down to it, like I love small press culture. Like I love chat books. I love when I have the time to do it. I love reviewing books. I love reading my friends' books and like writing as this kind of social thing where it's like, I feel like I experience this very particular kind of sociality through poetry that I don't get to experience otherwise. And when I was really excited about writing at a young age, I don't know if that is necessarily what I was hungry for. Maybe I was like on an unconscious level. Like maybe I thought that writing would make me feel less alone, but I don't think that I thought about it in this literal sense that like, yeah, I'm going to meet some like, you know, people that are like my best friends through poetry, you know? I mean, it's like, I mean, Joe, I like met you because I solicited you for my MFA journal, like for the Yalabusha Review when I was at the University of Mississippi, and we just started like emailing, and like that shit is like what keeps me around and is like what makes me care about poetry is that it's like, you know, the people that I've met through it, like the kind of the social aspect of it. And I, when I say social, I don't just mean like hanging out with people and going to parties or whatever, because in the pre-COVID times, that was super fun. Like I loved doing that, but social in the sense of like experiencing something with other people. I don't know. That sounds stupid, but hopefully y'all know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something really elemental to that. I don't think I would have kept writing after college if I hadn't, you know, like stumbled across a John Wiener's poem about being depressed that he's sweeping floors, and not feeling like somehow there was a kinship there or that he was speaking to me across time, and you know, recovering me from loneliness. So, you know, and it's interesting that you're describing an arc kind of from world making, you know, like I want to inhabit a world where I'm safe and I can, you know, just make it and be in it to, you know, bridging the distances between people to a kind of sociality and comradeship. I mean, does that answer the question of what you want art or writing to do to you as a reader, to make you feel seen or connected or,
I think so. I mean, I would say that, and I mean, probably related to that, I mean, I want it. It's so hard for me to answer that question in a way that doesn't feel like I'm spouting cliches, but I honestly want writing to make me feel like I'm seeing things differently. I want to feel seen by the things that I'm reading, but I also want them to make me realize I'm not seeing everything, you know, and that like there's, you know, perspectives that are different from my own. Honestly, is like part of it. But yeah, like I mean, the writing that has meant the most to me is like that sort of like moment where you read something and you're like, this hits me in this particular way. Like it touches on something I've felt for a long time but haven't been able to verbalize. And yet it also verbalizes something that's like totally beyond what I thought about. And that sort of like duality between, you know, identification and knowing and just like absolute alterity is, that's like such an exciting thing about writing for me. And like, that's something that I feel like it's harder for me to stumble across that than, I don't know what it's like for other people, but I feel like I read something that gives me that exact like split duality, like maybe, I don't know, once or twice a year, if that, less even now, because I'm just like, so everything I read is just like in service of my stupid ass dissertation. So I feel like I have less freedom to kind of like go along the chain if it's like, I'll read this thing and this thing and this thing. And, you know, just kind of being at the whims of my own like immediate interests. But yeah, like I don't experience that a lot. Like I really can probably count on like two hands, maybe, the number of books that I've read as an adult anyway, that have like done that for me. And yeah, but those 8 or 9 books or whatever have like absolutely made it worth it. Like I'll read other stuff that's really exciting that I love, but like those books where it's like, I feel absolutely seen by this book, but I also feel like I'm seeing something just totally beyond myself. Like it's very pretty rare. Yeah,
that's great. You're thinking about art as being capable of like revealing parts of the world to you. Also like imagining or inventing new possibilities for the world. And another piece is also like often like unraveling parts of your reality as well, right? That seems to kind of like be part of this like world building project or world destroying project as well. And I'm interested in like where this might then veer off into the construction of like new ideas that might not always be grounded in reality, right? So what is like something that you believe, even though it's probably not true? This is one of my favorite questions.
I'm like circling around a few, I guess I'm circling around one answer, but what I'm struggling with is I don't know that I believe whether or not this answer is true to the question of like you know, it's a tongue twister. But I guess one thing that I struggle with as like a self-identified leftist, and I think other poets probably do as well, is like this very vexed question of whether poetry can affect political change. And the question of whether that's something that it needs to do. And the problem of like, if you're like, okay, well, poetry doesn't have to affect political change, but it has to have a politics. It has to be politically aware, which is like something that I do believe, but then it's like, who am I being politically aware for? Is it for myself? Is it for my small readership? Like those questions are difficult for me. And I'm not sure that I necessarily have an answer to them. I do think that my like poems at this point in my life like do align with like my political beliefs to a certain extent. And there was a period of my life where I knew that they did not align. And I feel like I've worked through that. But now that I'm like, well, I have these political beliefs and I have these poems that I'm writing, I'm not sure how those go together anymore. I'm not sure like how to push that, like if I need to push that. That's my answer.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like an incredibly important question and probably a good thing to be unsettled in regard to. All right. So it's completely non sequitur time, Marty. What do you think of machines?
I think that machines are pretty cool. But I don't know. I like my ideal vision of a machine is that I'm not privileging electric machines or like digital technologies over anything else, and that I'm thinking of my body as much of a machine as like a computer. Like I don't know what to do with that. I don't have anything smart to say about that equivalency other than the fact that it animates me as a poet, particularly as like a poet who has always felt like comfortable typing. Like I know, Joe, you're not like that. I know you're like a handwritten poet, and that's fucking crazy to me. Like I've never ever been able to do that. I am like straight to the keyboard, and the only times I've ever written by hand is when I don't have any other option, but I always feel like I can't like write as fast as my brain is working. And like, that's what I'm thinking about machines the most, is like when I'm interfacing with this machine to, you know, translate the thoughts that my machine of a brain is producing at this very particular pace.
Yes.
That's what I think of machines.
Yeah, I was going to try and move smoothly to the next one, but instead it's just, Marty, what is waste?
Oh, shit. Well, this is another one I feel like I have multiple answers to. One, I'm tempted to say that waste is anything that cannot easily be instrumentalized by capitalism to produce more things. On the other hand, I've toyed with at times like the idea of thinking about poetry and like my working with poetry as like, you know, working with like a kind of waste and poetry with as a kind of waste. But I think I'm like resistant to that idea because it's hard for me to be like, yeah, man, I'm fucking producing waste when I write poems, when I've like, and I always have clean drinking water. And that's always like a privilege that I've enjoyed. So I like the actual word waste, I feel like the connotations of the word waste are like a difficult thing for me to work with in an artistic sense. I do, however, like I'm very comfortable with like thinking of my relationship to art. And like, I mean, like, I don't know if it's something that I succeed at, but I certainly like strive for the idea of like creating art that cannot be easily instrumentalized by capitalism. Like that. And I don't want to say that's like, that should be the end goal of all artists, because I mean, if somebody has like found a way to like hack it at the shit that I do and like, you know, eat off it, like that's fucking sick. Like but that's not my relationship to it. Like I'm interested in making art that is like never going to like fit seamlessly into capitalist spaces. That's my dream of it anyway. Maybe my work does easily fit into those spaces, I don't know. But my like the kind of like work that excites me the most is like work that is, you know, very uneasy within canonical spaces, work that's uneasy within institutional spaces. Yeah, that's what gets me psyched about writing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just like art in general. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I mean, and I think there's, you know, different ways to think about waste. I know Amiri Baraka has the thing about like, he wanted to write poems like picking up trash off the street. And the idea that it couldn't easily be assimilated by capitalism is a generative one too, I think, in the sense that like, even if capitalism does absorb something, you know, like if it's truly waste, it'll produce a corrosive byproduct that, you know, that like,
right. Yeah.
That there is no space for. Yeah.
I think that's like where it gets like tricky for me is it's like, I mean, yes, waste is not, unless it has like, you know, some kind of reproductive byproduct, it's not going to be easily absorbed back into capital. But like, yeah, it fucking produces waste all the time. I mean, that is like, capitalism like does produce waste, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, I don't know. I was like having a conversation today with one of my skateboard friends, and we were like talking about electric longboards and how like that's become a thing and how fucking stupid it is and how nobody needs electric longboards. And like, oh, that is like the innovation that capitalism had brought us. That is waste. Like that is fucking waste. Like it exists to like create like dopamine for like a second and like have people buy it, but it's waste. I mean, there's nothing generative or useful about that. I mean, I don't know, maybe somebody's gonna drop some fucking sick like electric longboard street park and like make me like eat my words, and I'll be like, oh, actually this is some badass like subcultural shit. But I feel like that's probably not gonna happen. That's my hunch. So yeah, like the thing about like waste is like inimical to capitalism in one sense, but I also feel like it's like part and parcel of it in another. And that's like why I feel uncomfortable with like going like the full fucking Bataille route and being like, yeah, like I fucking produced waste, man, because I don't know. I mean, I think that the art I like is like, it's productive for something. Like, I mean, like, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't like it. Like it's productive for me at the very least. And most trash does not, you know, produce joy in me. Some does, but it's not my relationship to, like, you know, most waste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point that capitalism does produce waste, and often the production of that waste keeps some people, usually marginalized communities, from reproducing themselves, right?
Yes.
And so, which also, you know, if they can't reproduce themselves, turns them into like super exploitable labor, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that I think that's a great point. So from the multiple valences of waste, both utopic and dystopic vis-a-vis capitalism, what you been listening to, Marty?
What have I been listening to?
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. Well, it's varied a lot. Like my listening habits have changed in substantial ways since I had a kid. Like before I had a kid, I was playing a lot of like, not a lot, I was playing in exactly one punk band, which you were in at one point, Joe, Joyous Shrub, formerly known as Joyous Shrub 666. Joe is the bassist for this band. Yeah, I mean, sort of like coming off that, the beginning of COVID, I was listening to a bunch of like, you know, hardcore punk, like Power Violence. And then my kid was born and I was like, oh, I have to listen to quiet stuff because I have a baby. But then I realized babies don't care, you know, like, I mean, it's like the volume, you know, but it's like if it's at an appropriate volume. Like for a while I was on, I don't know, when I was in high school, I was like a punk kid. So I never like allowed myself to listen to emo because you weren't supposed to like emo if you're a punk kid. And I like threw a skate video for the first time in my life. It was like, oh shit, like I really like Sunny Day Real Estate. So I was listening to a bunch of Sunny Day Real Estate recently, and my baby, like, fucking, she loves Sunny Day Real Estate. I don't know what it is about it, the whininess, because she's a baby, I don't know. But she really vibes with it. So I was on a huge emo kick for a while, and that sort of subsided. And like, I don't know, I like played some like jazz guitar and piano in high school, and that shit has sort of been coming back. I've been like listening to a lot of like Coltrane and Thelonious Monk, and like, you know, in terms of more contemporary stuff, like Kamasi Washington. And I've just been like, I don't know, I play piano badly, but I've just been like dicking around on my piano more recently, and that has been feeding into what I've been listening to. So, but then it's also like when I'm like, I just desperately need to finish these dishes, I need to finish washing these bottles or whatever, and I'm fucking exhausted, I'll just go to the like absolute, you know, lowest common denominator and be like, I'm gonna listen to pop punk, and that's what I go for. So so pop punk and jazz is in the last 2 weeks is sort of what I would say.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, my kid was really little, he really liked listening to Death Grips.
Really?
Yeah, for some reason he would always dance whenever we put that on. So
it's like the super rhythmic shit. It's like the louder the drums, the more they like it. Yeah. And I think that's really what it is with Sunny Day Real Estate, is the drums are so loud in the mix, and she loves that, you know. Yeah. Yeah, for like a while there's this like I don't know if it's not a band, it's like just these two dudes who have this project called like Sparrow Sleeps, and they do like lullaby covers of pop punk songs and like emo and shit. And I listened to that so much, like the first 2 months of her life, and it was awesome. They're very like, actually, like they're great. I mean, there's so many, like that's like a whole musical market is like lullaby covers of shit, but their covers are like, the arrangements are like amazing and like very well thought out. Like I challenge all of the, you know, probably single, no offense guys, probably single digit listeners to this thing that I'm saying, to this recording that I'm speaking on right now. I challenge all of y'all to listen to the Sparrow Sleeps version of Ocean Avenue, and if it does not bring a tear to your eye, you're fucked up. It is beautiful. But I sort of like went through that very quickly, and that was like really like the depths of like sleep deprivation, and I was like, I have to listen to soft music all the time. And then I went through this period where I was like, when I would get in the car and I'd be by myself, I would be like, I need to listen to the most like fucking, I need to listen to like Dark Throne, or I need to listen to like fucking Slayer, like the heaviest, loudest shit imaginable. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that, like, it's like this combination of having a kid and COVID, which like has, like, I mean, playing in bands and like the whole like live music thing was like a huge part of my life, which has just kind of been destroyed by COVID. And I've had to find other things to kind of like fill in that gap. So yeah, my relationship to listening has changed tremendously. I'm realizing now that when you said, what have you been listening to? Smart boy that you are, Joe Hall, I probably could have been like, I've been listening to the voice of my baby or my wife or something, and you would have been fine with that. And I just assumed you meant music, which was foolish.
Well, yeah, we are looking for recommendations. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
That we need to listen to.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Unless you want to start recording your baby or your wife, and then we'll listen to that. But
yeah,
I might. Yeah. I've been writing some songs, like for whatever reason, writing songs makes a little bit more sense to me right now than writing poems. Yeah. I think it just takes less brain activity for me because I'm not as good of a songwriter as I am as a poet.
Yeah. So, across like the conversation, we've quite a few times been talking about this like weird like liminal state that we feel like we're all caught in, but you have particularly like articulated that quite a few times, and you're also talking a bit about different types of art that are imagining new possibilities. So I'm interested, this is like our last question, and it's a question taken from Bernadette Mayer's like journal ideas and writing experience, which is, what is poetry or writing or the medium of the future? You can kind of take that in whatever direction you want.
Oh, that's such a like a Bernadette Mayer question. And that it like for me, like I love Bernadette Mayer. She's one of my absolute favorite fucking writers, but I feel like where questions sort of invite this like kind of stupid literal response, and you're like, that's a dumbass response, like I should think of something cooler than that. And like that's how I find myself responding to a lot of her questions. But that one specifically, I don't know that I want writing in the future to be like fundamentally different than what writing is now. Like, I mean, I say that as a person with, like, you know, many degrees of privilege that allow me a relationship to writing that other people are not able to have. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, but I mean, I think writing is fucking awesome and has made my life a lot better. And I want more people to be able to experience that. I mean, in a way that's just not more capitalist bullshit. That's like finding more people to like market this idea of writing to, like the idea of more people getting organically psyched about writing on its own merits. Like, that's what the writing of the future is to me, because I mean, like, for me personally, I don't feel like it has to be any different than it is now. There's many things that I would change if it were up to me, that I would change about like literary community and small press communities and like poetry communities. There's a lot of things that I don't like and that make me unhappy and that unsettle me. But when it comes down to it, I feel lucky that I've been able to like find my people through poetry, and like, and that's like enough for me at this point, you know? And the writing of the future, like my ideal would be like for other people to experience that as well, because yeah, that's what it's about. I don't know. It's about meeting homies, you know?
Well, that's a beautiful, meeting homies is a beautiful note to end on. Marty, if you were to tell our listeners, who are primarily the people who we're going to interview subsequently, where to find your work, or if there's something you'd want them to check out, what would you direct them to?
Well, I just had a book come out. I just got my author copies the other day from Trembling Pillow Press. It's called The Wound Is Not Real, a memoir. It was like originally my MFA thesis in like 2015. So it feels like it's definitely work I'm still proud of, but it's like a book that I would not write now if I were writing a book again. But I would say, check that book out. I think it's still pretty good. I had a piece in Annulet. Joe, I know you also had an amazing piece in Annulet recently. Annulet is one of the like new journals that I'm the most psyched about, but I had a piece in the inaugural issue of Annulet called The Dogs Woke Me Up that I'm pretty proud of, that I think in a lot of ways like synthesizes my academic and poetic interests. So I'm proud of what happened there. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a great piece. Yeah, everybody check it out. Marty, thank you so much for joining Green Space and answering our questions.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure.
Hell yeah.